You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Carrie Lutz. Today is 4/22/21. Well, you know, when you go to Wall Street, it's kind of like Oliver Twist. If you went to Fagin's hangout and you had money hanging out of your pockets, by the time you got through that little warren of thieves, you would be broke. And many of you often feel that's the case on Wall Street. And there's a new book out that I highly recommend. It's called Foolish: How Investors Get Worked Up and Worked Over by the System. I've been one of those people myself, so I can attest to the fact that if you don't know what you're doing, you're in trouble. If you do know what you're doing, you're really in trouble. And the book is by Gil Baumgarten. Gil, you have 25 years on Wall Street, another 10 years as a fee-only fiduciary. And I would say you probably know a thing or two about what's going on in the financial world. So we welcome you to the show. And hey, if it's one lesson you've learned on Wall Street, and as being one of the nation's top respected financial advisors, what is the biggest lesson you've learned?
There's two real problems, and the book addresses this. Is the first is that the house always wins. The way the traditional investor would engage with Wall Street is through a traditional stockbroker at one of the big firms, and they have invented much of the system that they require those investors to play in, and they extract fees in multiple layers, that most of which is opaque. And investors don't understand how that works. That's issue number one. And issue number two is investors have a lot of self-harm tendencies. They have a lot of mental baggage. They have a lot of problematic decision-making that occurs mostly from fear and greed mentalities that set in at just the wrong time. And those orchestrate together to really harm overall investor results.
So true. You know, that just reminds me when you said the house always wins, there's a guy and there with his wife in Vegas, and she's playing like a dollar blackjack, and she loses $200 and gets really upset. How could you lose that much money? That's terrible. And you don't know what you're doing. And she looks at him and says, well, I lost 200. You lost 10,000. He said, yeah, but I knew what I was doing. So yeah, being that, look, like Robin Hood, free trading for all, right? Never pay another fee to trade. But the reality is something much darker and uglier than that, isn't it?
That's true. You know, the in the book, we talk about how Wall Street makes money. And I don't know, I think we had 8 or 9 layers that people are generally unaware of. And I would ask you the question, where do you think that free trading comes from? They make money in lots of different ways. In several of the brokerage firms whose balance sheets I have looked at, many of them make 2/3 or more of all their earnings off of idle credit balances that they allow to sit on their balance sheets inside of client accounts that they in turn reinvest and earn interest for themselves. That's one way that they make money. And the other way they make money is, and this is a little more insidious, they actually sell glimpses of client trading activity fractional seconds before execution. And you have professional traders out there that subscribe for a fee to these information feeds that the brokerages sell, and they build algorithms to jump right out in front of that client trade and make very small amounts of money, but they do it tens of thousands of times a day, and they actually make a very lucrative living from that, and that's the reason why they will pay for that. And so if people think that the system has tons of integrity, they're not exactly thinking of it correctly, and that's the reason why these trades can be free, because they're making their money in another way.
It's so true what you're saying. I've seen it. there's a guy named Harvey Houtkin, one of the originators of day trading, and he used to call it MGM, which stood for Morgan, Goldman, Merrill. And they were the basically the cartel.
Right.
Yeah, like pretty much these free trading platforms. I would call them the Facebook of stock trading. Because like Tim Cook once said, the CEO of Apple, when it comes to Facebook, when it comes to these social media platforms, you are the product.
Yeah, if you're not paying for it, you are the product. That's for sure.
You're the product and people are buying your data. And that's exactly what they're doing there. And the Citadels of the world front end you for a nickel. And look, it's kind of elemental. If somebody steals a nickel from you, you might not even know because you had the tip on the table and somebody rushed by and took a quarter. Like, so what?
But when they do it 10,000 times, it gets a little more substantial.
Yeah.
There is, I don't want to be totally negative about it because there is a good byproduct that comes from that. If you look back or think back to the 80s and 90s, if you did any stock trading, you'll remember that the spread between the bid and the ask was an eighth of a dollar. So 12 and a half cents was if you were buying and selling, that's as narrow as you could get the spread because a specialist was out there to capture that eighth of a dollar. Well, when you look at bid and ask spreads today on J&J or Coca-Cola or whatever, it is a penny. And the rapid fire traders like the Citadels are the ones who can make money inside of that spread. And they're normally making a fraction of that penny. And that means that overall liquidity has improved dramatically, giving investors an easy in and an easy out of their transactions. And on top of that, those spreads that they otherwise would have paid 12 and a half cents for have contracted down to a penny. So while on the one hand, I think it's kind of a negative phenomena and I don't think it's quite kosher, it does have a positive effect for investors in the end.
As long as the market's going up, because as we've seen, when you have liquidity driven events, then all the liquidity that a Citadel puts in, and Citadel calls themselves a market maker.
Right.
I mean, I guess in the strictest definition of the word, they are a market maker, but they're a fair weather market maker.
That's right. That liquidity dries up when nobody wants to buy the securities and it, that knife cuts both ways.
They're not like the old-fashioned specialist, which being a specialist on the floor of the market, if you weren't aware, that was like top of the food pyramid on the floor. And your firm was a specialist. You just had guaranteed multi-million dollar profits every year.
That's right.
Until the market blew up. But what the specialist had to do, at least in the initial stages of a crash, was reach into their own pocket and create a market. So they got that money, but they got some risk with it. Citadels.
That's exactly right.
Right. The Citadels, who are the new market makers, the digital market makers, they are fair weather because once it hits the fan, you guys at the SEC or at the Fed, you better do something because we're not doing anything. And that has steepened and hastened these market declines, hasn't it, Gil?
Yeah. I'd like to compliment you on your understanding of these machinations. Most people that I talk to about these things don't have enough information around the background of it, and you seem to have a very good grip of it.
I'm a recovering attorney, but I've been involved for over 40 years, and I went to school downtown, so I was right around the corner from Broad and Wall, and I see. And the other thing people don't understand is they think there is still a stock market. Like that building on the corner of Broad and Wall is the financial nerve center. And that is really a stage setting. It's a backdrop. It's just like, I don't really have these books behind me on the shelf there. I just put it up on the screen. That's what they're actors of on Wall Street. Yeah. They do not
very much.
Volume is so minuscule. And then, by all rights, it couldn't have been any other way. The markets had to go digital in order to handle the volume, right? There was no.
That's right. That's true.
Yeah. So getting into your book, and I found some things real interesting there. One of the questions was brief history of the stock market. We've kind of covered that.
Yeah, we have.
But when you go back to the late 1800s, when the markets were evolving, it was a whole different kind of ball game. Nobody ever liked Wall Street, especially like the Henry Fords of the world, and many of the industrialists, I think Andrew Carnegie's didn't really care for the Morgan-backed financial system. Mm-hmm. Have we really evolved from the late 1800s to where we are now?
Well, you know, the digitization is the latest iteration of it. I think another really important thing happened back in the 1970s. You know, I think it, in the book we talk about the Gulf Sulphur Company and the insider trading scandal that occurred in the, I think it was 1972. Yeah. Insider trading had actually been illegalized back in the 1930s, but the SEC didn't take action. And an insider trading scandal came up in the 70s that ultimately forced the SEC to begin to enforce rules that had been on their books for 40 years. And at that moment in time, the ability for a so-called stock broker to add a lot of value became much more difficult. Now, the typical broker can add a lot of value over what an investor would traditionally know and understand, but he had, prior to the 1970s, access really to insider trading information because the SEC didn't enforce actions against it. Imagine if I was doing business with the CEO of Coca-Cola or any publicly traded company, and he were to give me some inside skinny on some company that they were acquiring, I would have the freedom to go out and take that information, buy the acquired company prior to that, put it in my client accounts. 2 days later, they announce they're buying the company out and the stock shoots up by $4. And that was easy money to be made. So back in the day, in the 60s in particular, you could, with reckless abandon, use insider trading information to enhance client trading activity and create a fantastic conduit of information. That process has gotten totally obliterated through regulatory authority, which it should have been, and just through the democratization of the process of digitizing all this information. And the internet has completely pedestrianized all information, and the ability to gain information and trade on it profitably has become much more difficult. And there's other ways that people can compound their money much more safely if they understand how the system is built.
Yeah. Yeah. And so interesting, because up until the 90s, you had to call your stockbroker to place a trade.
Yeah.
Guys like Harvey Houtkin and the Soz bandits really were instrumental in introducing online trading. And as a result, they cut into a major, major portion of Wall Street's profits.
Yes.
Wall Street had to go to other things like subprime mortgages and securitization of any cash flow stream on the planet in order to keep their profits going.
Yeah.
And all really interesting. There is one market where insider trading is totally permissible and allowed, and that's in commodities, and the payoffs there can be way higher than in the stock market if you have the right insider information.
Yes. You know, but there's also other disadvantages to that. You know, transactional centric methodologies are extremely difficult to produce long-term track records of results. You have to, in one flash in the pan, good result does not necessarily lead to another one. Commodities also have terrible tax treatment. You know, even if you have mark-to-the-market accounting on them that requires you to pay tax on the increase in market value, even when you have not realized that profit yet, you also can't ever get long-term capital gains tax treatment out of a commodity. And then you have to repeat the process next year and, you know, find the next insider information. Whereas you compare that to the stock market, which rises 81% of the time, my gosh, if you maintain broad and inexpensive diversification in the stock market, you have fantastic tax attributes and extremely low cost if you do it the right way. And we explain in the book what those right ways are to avoid getting your pocket picked by the typical Wall Street methodology.
All right, which leads us to the next thing, ETFs.
Yes, sir.
And ETMs, are they a bonanza for investors, or are they another way for Wall Street to fleece you?
Don't just survive, thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Arcana Corporation is on the verge of bringing the world's highest grade silver mine into production. The Revenue Virginius mine in Colorado has proven improbable silver reserves grading nearly 37 ounces per ton silver with an all-in sustaining production cost of only US $8 per ounce of silver. The mine is fully permitted with infrastructure already in place, and the company has announced they plan to commence production in 2020. Achieving successful production usually results in a significant upward share price re-rating on the Lassonde curve. Arcana trades under the ticker AUN in Toronto and AUNFF in New York. To learn more, go to arcana.com. That's A-U-R-C-A-N-A.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
For the most part, they are a bonanza. But it is not the bonanza that most people perceive it to be. It's actually for another reason. Most people perceive that ETFs provide them an easy way to buy a diversified basket of securities, much like a mutual fund, and they are, in fact, mutual funds. But they have some other attributes that most people don't understand. The first is they are extremely low cost by and large. There are some expensive ETFs, and that's another issue entirely. But they're the typical ETF versus the typical mutual fund. The typical mutual fund internal operating expenses are roughly six times the typical ETF. There's issue number one. But that's not the valuable part of ETFs. The valuable part is the tax treatment of an ETF. If you own an open-ended mutual fund, the buying and selling of securities through active management versus passive methodology that's typically inside of an ETF creates realized gains that have to be distributed at year end. And most people who've owned an open-ended mutual fund, I'm talking about the ones with five-digit symbols, they will find a capital gain distribution on their 1099 and they have to pay tax on that money. That erodes compounding. That can cost you 1/4 of your compounded return over a long time period. But that's not even the big one. The big one is that you lose your ability to get a step up in basis at the death of the first owner. Under current rules, and Mr. Biden wants to change this, if you carry forward an unrealized gain for 10 years, 20, 30 years, the death of the first spouse erases the taxability of that gain. Because a mutual, traditional open-ended mutual fund has investors who enter and leave the fund, they take out of that system the compounded gain that, one, deteriorates compounded return when you have to pay taxes along the way. But far worse is the fact that you're giving up the low basis holding that you could have used for a step up in basis at the death of the first spouse. And so that is really the powerful compounding part of an exchange traded fund that Wall Street typically doesn't want an investor to own, because they don't get paid in the backdoor ways through the ETF process that they would otherwise in an open-ended mutual fund.
Okay, so that is something I honestly never knew anything about, Gil. And that's a big plus, because the fact is, if you've got any kind of money, you got to be doing estate planning. And estate planning has boomed in the age of COVID. It's amazing, myself included. I had it, and I said, my God, everything is a mess here. I'm just going to leave my kids a mess. They're going to have to like follow breadcrumb trails, figure out where everything is. And I totally restructured everything. And if you haven't done that out there, do it now.
Yeah.
Telling you, nothing like a brush with death will come you, make you into a total proponent of estate planning. And something like you've outlined, Gil, the ability to step up basis in any...
It's profound. So how it would manifest is if you had a 30-year time period and you start with $1 million and I start with $1 million and you own a traditional open-ended mutual fund, you go through and earn your 8% rate of return, and you get to the end of that time period and you've paid all your taxes, you have about $5.9 million. I, on the other hand, have $8.4 million that's been compounding all this time. And a simple death, either me or my spouse, would completely wipe out the difference between your pile and my pile and make my pile $3 million more valuable than yours, all of the things being equal. I'm not even talking about the fee differential, which would also make the $8.4 million, $8.3 even higher. That means that every single dollar that I earned for the past 30 years was 49% more valuable than every dollar that you earn. And people spend all this time evaluating How can I get an angle from this Fidelity mutual fund? Which strategy should I employ with this mutual fund? How should I structure my portfolio? I'm like, man, you're playing the wrong game. You need to be looking at the taxes and the costs of this and how it compounds so that you can create a portfolio that really is powerful later in life and not give you the periodic ego boost of having outsmarted the market and figured out what's going to happen next. Because I can tell you what's going to happen next when you pass away and you've given away all your step up and basis rules.
I, you know, there's so much to this and I've seen it work. I've seen people get burned on this. And I should mention that we're going to have you on again for sure. Your website, Segment Wealth Management, SegmentWM.com, right? That's where we...
Yes, that's correct. I also write a blog and people can sign up for it for free, SegmentWM.com/blog. They can go right there and sign up and we write about these topics, once a month, sometimes twice a month. We post them, everybody gets an email. And you can unsubscribe anytime you want to, and it's totally free.
All right. Good thing to know. We've got a bunch of other questions, but I could go on with you all day, honestly, but we're limited for time. But just share with us your thoughts on what happened with Reddit and GameStop. Let me just share my opinion on it. I mean, I think that that Reddit was played by a number of large hedge funds because short positions that were out there, naked shorting. Another thing that's illegal that the SEC has not enforced, 140% of a stock being shorted, you have these phantom shorts. And in reality, how many shares can they really short?
Right.
So I think that there's opportunistic hedge funds that saw this and they manipulated Reddit to some extent. It was starting months before and it ended in that crescendo of the mother of all short coverings.
Yeah. I think that there's a lot of manipulation also going on the part of the Reddit users that did conspire, did try to drive the price higher. And just for your listeners who might not be familiar with what shorting it is, it's simply the borrowing of securities on margin from another owner that a brokerage firm will provide, and you sell them in your own account with the promise to buy them back later. You have to have margin paperwork, and you have to sign a collateral agreement that's basically obligating you to buy those shares back, and you hope to do so at a lower price. Well, when the market price of that security goes up, you can get squeezed because your losses are unlimited. If you short a $10 stock, the most you can make is $10 because all it can do is go to zero. If it goes to 20, you've lost 100% of your money. If it goes to 30, you've lost 200% of your money. And when it goes to 300, like what happened with GameStop, you could lose 15 or 20 times your account value. So it can get super dangerous, as you have just cited. But I do think that there was some orchestration of effort to squeeze those GameStop shorts. And that is technically illegal to do that. It's not illegal to squeeze a short. It is illegal to conspire to do so with other investors. The problem is that most of those investors are such small investors and there's so little money involved individually and so many people participating. Imagine the enormity of the problem that the SEC has. You know, we're going to prosecute you for your $300 conspiring to short or squeeze the shorts in GameStop. It's just an unpunishable offense. So I don't particularly have a problem with it because short sellers should be aware of what that risk is. I'm sure that they're going to cry foul and give a lot of political contributions to make it an effort in the future. But hey, what's done is done as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. And let's not forget, Gil, that if the SEC had been doing its job in the first place, it wouldn't have had 140% short ratio there.
Yeah, that's one issue. And instead, they were mesmerized by Reg BI, which they spent years and years and years negotiating with Wall Street to change the rules of engagement in such a way that Wall Street was happy with it, trying to make a best interest standard apply to a brokerage firm, which should not have a best interest standard, in my opinion. And then they ended up passing this 80-page legislation and calling it regulation best interest, when in fact it still is only suitability as the standard of care. And it says on page 5 of the 80-page regulation that a wholesale adoption of a best interest standard fiduciary-like at in a brokerage firm is incompatible with the brokerage firm's business model. Totally understand that, then don't call it regulation best interest. Call it something else, but it leaves people with the impression that they're going to get a best interest standard of treatment at a brokerage firm when they are not.
No, that goes to the whole core functions of the SEC, which you just mentioned, because every security other than those exempt have to be registered with the SEC, and you have ongoing filings. And your average investor thinks if the SEC allowed them to register the securities, that's an imprimatur of legitimacy.
That's right.
And the fact is, as long as you disclose everything in your prospectus, which no average ordinary investor ever is aware of, let alone right. I just happen to read them on occasion.
Yeah.
I know what they say, but you can say the guy is an axe murderer. He's currently in for a mass murder in wherever, and he's got a record of armed robbery and fraud convictions. And as long as you spell it out there, and as long as he hasn't been barred from being an officer of a publicly traded company, everything's fine, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't really object to disclosure being the backstop to limit liability, because a broker can find himself in a lot of situations that he should not be, he or she should not be exposed to liability. You know, some guy walks in the door with 10 stock certificates that he inherited from his Uncle Ralph, and he wants to turn those into cash. You don't know where they came from. You don't know this person. You don't know what their goals and objectives are. I am not going to take on the fiduciary liability of navigating, liquidating this $100,000 that they just inherited and cut them a check and be forever liable on how I handled every little thing. There is a place in the world for a brokerage transaction to walk in the door. I'm going to help you turn this into cash. You're going to walk out with a check, you know, 2 or 3 business days from now, and my liability to you is over with. There is a great place for that in the brokerage community. And from a rule standpoint, it needs to be set up that way. It's only problematic when an investor begins to believe that that broker is looking out for them in all ways possible and is an advocate for that client. And that advocacy type of relationship is not well placed inside of a brokerage methodology.
That's why you go to a fee-based financial.
That's exactly right. Because I have liability and responsibility to understand all the nooks and crannies of that client's needs. And I'm willing to hang my hat on my responsibility to do what's right for that client in a fiduciary liability methodology.
And what I was saying, I'm totally in favor of disclosure, full disclosure, even beyond what's required now.
That's right. Yeah.
But the disclosure requirements are extremely stringent, but they could be better in certain respects. We don't need to get into that.
Yep.
What I'm against is the average investor or the average person, the least sophisticated consumer, even a mildly sophisticated consumer, believes that it's legit. Because the SEC filed the paperwork and listed the and they were allowed to list the shares. And that is a misconception in many governmental entities, that somehow because they're there, they're watching out for you. And in theory, all that's true. But in reality, their primary responsibility is to ensure that the disclosure requirements are complied with. Well, we got to get...
It is far better than the Wild West that could exist in the absence of that, but it's probably not as good as it could be.
And that did exist prior to the Securities Act of, was it 1934?
33 and 34, yeah.
34. That's what we had, the Wild West, and that's why they made Kennedy the first SEC commissioner, because he knew how to scam the system better than talk about ironies.
Yeah, but, exactly.
Hey, we really appreciate you coming on. You're going to go on our regular rotation here, Gil.
Thank you.
Really, you're a wealth and breadth of knowledge. Again, just tell people where to find you, how to connect with you on the web.
Yes, segmentwm.com. So SegmentWM, Segment Wealth Management. And my blog is segmentwm/blog. You can log on there.
Perfect. And there's a link in the show notes to this interview on Financial Survival Network. If you got a question for Gil, just send it to my personal email address, kl@carrylutz.com. We'll forward it off to him. Make sure you sign up for your free newsletter on financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Gil, been a real pleasure. I look forward to speaking with you and reading your book as well.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.